Yeah, thanks everyone for coming today. So we'll get a little bit away from kind of the automated syndromic surveillance and that we've been dealing with the previous presentations. But today I'm going to talk about creating an electronic-based veterinary surveillance system in Washington, D.C. I'm currently at the D.C. Department of Government finishing up a two-year CSD fellowship, and this is one of the projects I was able to work on during my time there. For a little bit of background on animal surveillance in D.C., as in many jurisdictions, the small animal side of reportable diseases is limited to rabies only by law. I know a lot of areas of the country there's livestock diseases that are reportable, but usually across the board it's limited to just rabies. Our goal was to develop a system to kind of establish some of the other baseline rates for maybe some diseases of public health concern that could develop in small animals. Being landlocked in the national capital region and a small city metropolitan area, we only have small animals. There's no livestock or anything like that, so we're a little bit unique in that respect where we don't have to think about foreign animal diseases or anything that might be imported. To establish this system, we set out to build it with the veterinary community, so it wasn't, since everything's voluntary, all the diseases we added weren't, at least right now, and there's no plan to add them to be required by law to report. So we really wanted to work with the vets in D.C. to kind of see what they would see that would benefit them on a daily basis and their clients. And so it wasn't us trying to dictate what they had to do on a daily basis. It was something they could see value in as well. And then we built in a syndromic surveillance of a sense. It's not automated as in Essence is, but I'll get to that a little bit later, but it requires a little bit more of manual inputs. And the overall goal of the system was to be able to collaborate with our human syndromic surveillance to be able to work to identify potential bioterrorism events early, and also to be able to improve animal health and community health within the district. So to develop the system, our first strategy after reaching out to the veterinary clinics was to come up with a survey of different diseases we'd like to include in the system and basically let everyone vote on the frequency of reporting, what diseases to include, and some other aspects, including what client identifying information to include, because that's something that's a little bit different than the human side, where we don't really need to know anything about the owners of the pets, basically their location. The most common, so first we asked the clinics if they're interested or not. DC, there's at the time that the survey was conducted, there were 17 functioning veterinary facilities. 10 facilities completed the survey. 9 of those said they were interested. 1 facility didn't. The diseases that were selected, the 9 facilities that indicated they'd want to participate in surveillance, selected canine leptospirosis and canine influenza, and then antibiotic-resistant infections was the third disease that was selected to include with reporting. The frequency of reporting for both weekly and syndromic surveillance was weekly reporting, so the options we gave were daily, weekly, monthly, and again, that was to hopefully generate buy-in so we're not dictating what everyone does, but they're kind of selecting it and working with us during the process. And for client identifying information, we gave everyone the option of address, pretty much anything you can think of, and zip code was the most commonly selected. So as you'll see later, when people are reporting a specific case, they only have to report the zip code of where the animal is located. And then getting feedback from the facilities as we rolled this out, they later requested that canine parvovirus be included with reporting efforts too, so that was built in afterwards. To make it so it was as automated as possible, so eliminating paper and faxing and things that might be seen burdensome on the daily level, we made an online reporting portal in SurveyMonkey. It's displayed as a screenshot of the first page. So when a user, the veterinary facilities, log in, they enter the date that they're submitting that case report, and then they can select their facility from a drop-down list. And then we built the system so if someone's logging in just to report once an antibiotic-resistant infection, a case of an antibiotic-resistant infection, for example, they go through yes-no screens is displayed here. And if they click yes, it'll go into the specific case report form for that condition. If they click no, it'll go to a second yes-no question, so they can only, they'll only have to see what they're wanting to report, so that will speed up the process. And then the very last section of it is for a syndromic reporting form. And again, if they click yes, that'll bring up the display for that. And to kind of show how this flows, we'll go through one example of a case report form. And the example I'll use is canine parvovirus. When a user clicks yes that they'd like to report a case of parvo at their facility, the first thing that pops up is another multiple choice question that will again branch off in two different paths. One being if they're reporting a case in a single adult dog, and another if they're reporting a case in a litter of puppies. Parvovirus is a vaccine preventable disease in dogs that it's part of the standard package. If you take your pet to the veterinary clinic, your dog, it's what's one of the standard puppy vaccines. It's can sometimes be common in shelter situations and situations where there is a lack of veterinary care. And the reason we allowed people, and this was built in later to allow people to report a litter of puppies in one shot, is sometimes it is associated with breeding situations. So instead of making users log in and log out several different times, if it is one of those situations, they can report that entire litter in one go. So if someone selects they want to report an adult case, and the other diseases are similar too, each case report form just goes through specific clinical signs and testing for that individual disease. And these case reports and the case definitions were built with a panel of practicing veterinarians within the district that identified themselves as wanting to participate more actively in building the process when we did that first survey. So at the start of every page starts with just the client zip code. And again, that's so we can somewhat identify areas of the city where these are occurring, see if there's any sort of clustering going on. And then signalment of the pets is next, and then general clinical signs. For parvovirus, it's an intestinal infection, so diarrhea, fever, things that you would expect along those. And the people can indicate the date that they started. And then with parvo, since it is vaccine preventable, the next thing it goes into is any sort of vaccine history. So if it's, for example, if we start getting reports of lots of dogs that are appropriately vaccinated and they're developing the disease, then that's something that might indicate a vaccine failure and something we can bring up to the manufacturer's attention. And it also allows the veterinarian to report a potential exposure site if they know it. So if they see a repeat offender client that's coming in with different puppies over and over again, that can, again, alert the health department if there is a breeding situation occurring that's not supposed to be. And then the last page of the adult form asks if a canine SNAP parvo test was formed. So this is just a benchtop ELISA test that's very common in veterinary clinics. It's with a simple fecal swab. It can detect if the virus is actively being shed from crypt cells, and it's very common at shelters and with any vet you would take your dog to. If, on the other hand, if someone indicates that they'd like to report a case in a litter of puppies, a different form appears. It gets the same information, but it allows a lot of stuff to report it in table form. So again, that way users don't have to continually log in and out. And this is just an example of the table. So again, the same clinical signs as for the adults, but it lets everything happen in one smooth transaction. And again, asking for potential exposure sites. So if there is a breeding situation that we need to address, we can do that quickly. And then the last page of the form of the, so if once you get past the four basic diseases we're including, then a syndromic surveillance report comes up. This was based on reporting different clinical signs on body systems. So every week we ask the clinics to kind of take a look at what they've seen in their facility, whether it's neurological cases, fever of unknown origin, and even dead on arrival, and then just kind of report aggregate numbers. We expanded this beyond dogs and cats to some more of exotic pet species, so ferrets, rabbits, rodents, and again, just to kind of get a snapshot is if we're seeing an increase in health trends, if that is something that the department should pay attention to. So one example, I'll just go through a couple of brief examples of results of what we had reported to us. We'll start with syndromic surveillance here. Of the time period we looked at, so the system launched last August, and then the end of the time frame we're looking at is last December. The one notable thing we saw was an increase of upper respiratory signs. With all the graphs that I'll display, the blue lines are cases reported in dogs, the orange lines are cases reported in cats, and then the solid red is how many facilities reported for that given week. And all the weeks just follow the standard MMWR format. And one disadvantage of the system is, since there are no baseline rates, the only way we can really investigate if these are truly an increased incidence or maybe just one clinic deciding to report for the first time that week is actually directly contact the clinic, get their opinion of whether that what they're seeing is out of the ordinary or if it's they just maybe got overambitious with reporting that week. Another finding of note is for the syndromic surveillance was dead on arrival. So if someone brings their pet into the office and it's already deceased, this orange box right here represents a time period where we escalated daily surveillance. So if there's a national special security event in the Washington, D.C. area, on the human side of surveillance, we use Essence daily. Essence is always running, but we actually generate reports daily with both Maryland and Virginia for a period before and after the event, again, to check for bioterrorism events. And then we supplement this with the veterinary surveillance at the same time. So normally, it's just on a weekly basis we're asking for reports, but during these select time periods, it's every day we're asking the clinics to do this. And with the time period surrounded by the green box here, that's when the Pope visited Washington, D.C. last fall. And then the second spike here I'll address a little bit later as we go on in the presentation. For passive surveillance, so for canine influenza, canine leptospirosis, and antibiotic-resistant infections, during this time period, no cases of canine influenza reported, and there was no cases of antibiotic-resistant infections reported. 4 cases total of canine leptospirosis were reported, and then none of them were associated with the same location of the city, and they were, since they appeared sporadically, it wasn't of anything of concern to us. And if you kind of keep in mind the red area we saw on the last slide, compliance with passive surveillance, so the specific disease we're looking at, was much, much higher than it was for syndromic surveillance. And that's, again, just because I think of it's a much easier to kind of wrap your mind around doing it for a specific condition versus the general clinical signs we're looking for. One thing that we were able to detect with the system was with our canine parvovirus surveillance. So last October, about a month after we added canine parvovirus, one facility contacted the department and told us that they'd actually been experiencing an increased number of cases than they're used to since the previous summer, and they shared historic data with us, including medical records and everything, so we could generate case reports and combine it with the existing data. When we did so, we saw an increase of cases starting that last summer and then peaking in about mid-September. And when we compared the number of cases that were reported in September versus the previous 3 months, there was about an 80% increase in those cases. And when we actually compare this time period with the syndromic surveillance chart that I showed earlier for dead on arrival, there's a rough correlation between them. This is likely because if parvo is left untreated, there's no specific treatment other than symptomatic treatment, but if that's not started early, it's often fatal. So why it's not, with the syndromic surveillance, it's not possible to exactly nail down if that was the cause of the increased deaths in the dogs, it's likely contributed to it. For the cases reported to the system that we captured with our online reporting, there was 33 cases of parvo reported total between 3 different facilities. And one of the facilities specialized in shelter animal medicine, so that's kind of fitting with trends that has been seen with this disease in the past. For the distribution of patients, pretty evenly split between male and female. There's a few outliers with age that brought up the average, but most of them were under a year of age, so fitting with a disease of puppies as we talked about previously. For the breed distribution, the number one breed reported was pit bulls. Again, that's something that's commonly been reported with these sorts of outbreaks in the past. And another thing to note too, so male and female, all those animals, none of them were spayed or neutered. For any sort of veterinary bat history they had, only one of them had a history of being vaccinated, and that vaccine was given by a family friend, and the whole series wasn't completed, so essentially none of the animals had been appropriately vaccinated. And almost all of them had a positive SNAP test, so these were all confirmed cases or either linked to another littermate. When we looked at the cases by zip code, they started in June, and they all started south of the Anacostia River in D.C., and kind of flared up there and spread out. This is an area of the city that at the time was only served by one veterinary clinic and had been, as far as human health care concerns, identified as areas that have a deficit. As we noticed these, the strategy we took, since this is a vaccine-preventable disease, was to issue a press release and encourage people to take their vets to receive routine veterinary care. As we issued this, it was picked up by several different media outlets, one radio station, a TV station, and a couple of websites. The local ABC 7 News that evening did about a two-minute segment, again, encouraging people what the signs are to look for if their pets are ill and to encourage them to take their pets to a vet to receive that standard care. In addition to this, we partnered with our Department of Parks and Recreation to post the following notice at all the 12 DC dog parks to encourage people to make sure their dogs are up to date on all recommended preventative measures before they use the dog parks. And this is just a picture illustrating where all the flyers actually hanging up. And then the following months after we issued this public awareness campaign, the cases fell down and returned to zero. So some general conclusions about what we saw with conducting surveillance with our veterinary system, and specifically with the parvo outbreak that we saw, is most commonly we can assume pretty safely that these were pets that had never seen a vet before. The strong indicators of this is that none of the pets were spayed or neutered. None of them had an appropriate vaccine history, and also that a lot of them were under that year of age. The importance of public messaging also emerged with this. I think part of the things like this kind of run their course through the community and will flare out on their own. I think we helped it kind of end a little bit sooner with getting that messaging out there, especially since the areas that we saw where there was a lot more cases didn't necessarily have a lot of veterinary access in the area. Getting the messaging about that this is a preventable disease and areas where you can go for low-income vaccines, things of that along those lines, I think helped get that messaging to people that might not have been exposed to it before. And even though the parvovirus isn't necessarily a disease of public health importance, it was significant for us because it allowed us to refine our response activities for any sort of disease that might be of more public health concern if it were to emerge, so such as canine influenza or canine leptospirosis. So with the media coverage that the system garnered with the parvo we reported, there is an interest for this kind of surveillance to be conducted with companion animals and veterinarians. Even though compliance was less than 100%, we saw that we were still able to establish trends within the city. The biggest challenge still remains the syndromic surveillance. As I alluded to before, there's a lot more compliance with the passive surveillance than there was with syndromic. So that's something that we'll need to address moving forward. And again, to keep the system running strongly and making sure that people are participating, it's continuing to engage and have that collaborative relationship with the veterinary community. So it's not something that people are perceiving as being forced on them, but something that they feel like they're an active part in. For acknowledgments, I'd like to thank the DC veterinary community for helping to construct the system, the DC Department of Parks and Recreation for assisting with hanging the flyers in our dog parks, and as well the DC Department of Health Office of Communications and Community Relations for helping to shape the media messaging. And then I'd also like to acknowledge CSD for giving me the opportunity to complete a fellowship at the DC Department of Health. And if anyone has any questions, feel free to bring them up now, and also my contact information is on the screen.
Thank you again. All of our presenters did a great job of keeping on time, and we'll take some questions for our One Health presentation. You didn't use the term One Health.
Hi, I'm Marianne, Chicago, and thank you for the presentation. I'm just curious, what is your plan for this surveillance system? Do you plan to expand to other diseases?
So I don't think we're planning to expand to anything else for the time being, just because, as you can imagine, compliance surges during those national special security events. It wasn't shown with these slides, but the Nuclear Security Summit, I don't know if you guys remember that from the news a few months ago, but that was another one. So it surges during those times and then kind of falls back down afterwards. I think the plan moving forward is to maybe do a second round of the survey like the first one we did to kind of explore what might be barriers to reporting and ways we can improve it and make it easier for vets on a daily level. Another potential avenue we can go with the future is our department just got REDCap, so I think potentially transferring it from SurveyMonkey to REDCap, so it's a lot less intensive on my end as far as extracting to Excel before we do any sort of analysis.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for the presentation. I was curious, did you discuss any feasibility of looking at electronic health records in veterinary clinics, or were any of the facilities actually pulling data out of an electronic system, or were they just kind of doing hand tallies?
I think some of them were actively querying their electronic medical records. I think that's something we would like to address with the next survey, to see what systems people actually use, if people would be adamantly opposed to any sort of link up. I think that's something that's a little bit different in the veterinary community versus everywhere we can link Essence, is since 99% of them, except a few corporate practices, are privately owned, I think it's a little bit more privacy concerns than we'd see. So we'd want to very carefully address that before, and we wouldn't want to ever say that we're going to start linking your systems if we didn't have people's permission.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, to maybe, you know, at least be able to extract data and kind of get it set up on some kind of a schedule.
Yeah.
I don't think the number of vendors in the veterinary world would be near what you see in the human world. We've been able to successfully do it in Nebraska. We've been able to link with the diagnostic lab, and I kind of pull a similar type of thing from the diagnostic lab.
And I reached out to both, I won't mention names, but the two specific reference labs, the big ones in veterinary medicine, so you know what they are without me saying them. There's a little bit of interest from one that never went anywhere as far as them gradually sending me reports so we could make sure if we're missing anything, we're catching it. And the other one I never heard back from, so that's another thing to potentially try again as we move forward and maybe share with them some of our results so they can see the value in it as well.
Hi, Eileen Farnan, Philadelphia Health Department. I was curious about the selection of the diseases that you were conducting surveillance for, and I understand that they may be of significance to veterinarians, and as a big proponent of the One Health sort of efforts, I would be curious why you didn't select diseases that would be of more consequence to human health, sort of to fit that One Health paradigm, and if there was any pushback at the health department to conduct surveillance for animal health specific diseases that don't have a consequence for human health.
So we tried to somewhat set ourselves up for success by trying to balance picking diseases that are potentially zoonotic with ones that they also fit the category of commonly do occur sometime in clinics. One disease is actually selected that we abandoned was babesiosis in cats. And again, that's just so rare that we didn't see any value of actually including it in the long run. So everything, kind of the guidance from the health department was it needs to be something of public health significance, and then parvo was kind of added afterwards just because we had so many requests for it. But that is, and in the small animal side too, at least things that would occur commonly, there's not as many diseases of public health significance that would we'd never be even be able to capture more than one or two cases every 2 years.
I also just really wanted to compliment you on the syndromic surveillance. I think
could
really play an important role in the future, and that's very interesting.
And that's definitely our biggest challenge right now, is just to encourage the compliance for that and think of ways that we can potentially make it easier for everyone to do it on a regular basis.
Are you sending reminder emails to the providers and following up when they don't report?
We're not following up when they don't report because it's all voluntary right now, so we're trying to walk that line between overly harassing the clinics and wanting them to be able to participate. But I am sending a reminder email every week, so that's something I forgot to mention. I send a reminder email to all the clinics every Monday, and then every Thursday or Friday I actually send a summary of last week's reported conditions to everyone. So that way, and every now and then I'll send for the last 6 months or so. My goal is to be able to, especially with the Parvo, generate some materials that they could be able to use even for client education purposes to help when people come in and think, I don't need this vaccine or necessarily need this or that, that they can show that, well, the Department of Health has noticed these trends and this is why it's important for you to vaccinate your pet for A, B, and C.
It takes us back to the sort of early days of syndromic surveillance.
Could come and use the microphone, it's being recorded.
I was going to say it takes us back to the sort of the early days of syndromic surveillance, where we actually, at least in Florida and in some places, we had hospitals reporting, had to go in and log in and report their numbers like that. And I think the experience that we had with that is it wasn't sustainable. I mean, you could sort of do it, and then you had compliance issues, and then you have some data missing, and you get into the point that you were talking about, which is overly harassing the facilities. So, you know, I think this is interesting and probably useful, but as we move forward, then obviously you have to think about kind of automatic extraction of the records or something else that's going to be a little more sustainable.
And that's definitely something that we'd like to consider. Even if we couldn't expand it to everywhere, there's currently one animal shelter in D.C. and one 24-hour hospital, so I think if we could even just partner with a select few, it could still maybe get that snapshot. But again, we'd want to be able to make sure that people aren't feeling compelled to do this since it all is on a voluntary basis, and we wouldn't want to make anyone concerned with privacy issues and avoid the system altogether.
Thanks.
I agree with Dave's comment. I was going to actually ask that this reminds me of the methodology of ILINET, where Sentinel locations or clinics in a given jurisdiction are asked to log in weekly and report their conditions. It is, though, difficult to sustain, and as we did in syndromic surveillance, that transition to figuring out the automated components that, especially I think with some partners, or if you can get denominator data so that you can understand how many even visits are dealing, the community's dealing with, might be an interesting indicator.
This is a really interesting presentation, and I congratulate you on doing something of value and building the relationships with these partners while still managing to do it in a very low-tech way. That can be a very common barrier in if people try to go too big, too fast. So I actually had a question about whether you've considered exploring something like this with the zoo. I think about the classic One Health example of like West Nile virus, where like zoos all over the nation were suddenly losing birds, and then people were starting like getting sick, and took a long time to converge those two trends. So I just wonder if that's something that you've thought about.
And that is, I think, at least for, and that's been something I've been meaning to do. We've had some visits to the zoos for other reasons. With the National Zoo in D.C., it gets into one of those where it's federal ground, so we always have to be asked by invitation to go assist with anything. But I think potentially including them with the next survey and helping to expand and refine that syndromic surveillance aspect too. One thing I forgot to add about the syndromic surveillance is to help, I guess, further generate excitement in it. We included some events of community concern, so people can also report suspected injuries related to dog fighting and suspected animal abuse. So we haven't gotten any reports of, we've got a few reports of suspected dog fighting, but that's before we redefined it with the dog fighting aspect. So before, I think it was just people getting upset at each other at the park and doing nips, which we don't, that's nothing we want to know about. There's nothing you can do about that every now and then. No one is betting on it. I think just someone's dog got too close to someone else's dog. But yeah, since we redefined it, we've had nothing along those lines. But I think that's something too, where that could help us if we're seeing any sort of potentially legal activities, a vet seeing a repeat offender or something for something suspicious, they can help target our animal control folks to that area.
Andrew, can you comment on the pit bull? 21 cases were in the pit bull breed. Mm-hmm. Are pit bulls incredibly popular in the DC region, or is that something that they are more susceptible to?
So with a lot of epidemiologic trends in small animal medicine, it's unclear whether some breeds are truly predisposed or if it's just overrepresented. Some breeds are more common in certain communities than others. So unfortunately, sometimes certain breeds are associated with communities that might not have as much access to veterinary care. So I think it's not necessarily that it's the breeds predisposed. I think it's just that's just commonly breeds that might not receive veterinary care.
Thank you. I was just happy to see that you didn't distribute canaries in cages throughout the city while the Pope was in town. No canaries in coal mines were harmed in the making.
Nope,
of
nope. Mm-hmm. And I guess the last thing I'd like to add is we were very happy we didn't see any cases of canine influenza. I think that's probably the greatest public health concern that we're monitoring right now. I mean, as there's been no evidence that it can jump from dogs to people, as everyone knows, the flu virus is highly adaptable, and there's been, over the last couple of years, outbreaks in the Illinois area and other areas of the country, so we were very happy to see that we didn't have any cases of that.
We have a round of applause.